Is the law the opposite of the gospel? I've written an article in the latest Issues Etc. journal titled, Is the Law Bad? Some Myths About God's Law. You can read it by subscribing to the online Issues Etc. journal. Just click the red subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. You can also read about Tim Wood's journey from many different Christian confessions to the sound and seamless theology of the Lutheran Confession, the free online Issues Etc. journal.
We had to pretend to be buyers of these parts. And so some would say, well, you're lying.
I think that undercover work is actually fundamentally different from lying, because the purpose of undercover work is actually to serve the truth.
Coming out does not require as much courage as is required by a person who says, you know, I feel same-sex attraction, but what I want to do is not act on it. What I want to do is live up to my church's teaching.
All I know is that I'm died for by Jesus. I'm baptized and I'm forgiven, and God, I am the possessor of God's promises and His kingdom and His Spirit and His life, and that is who I am. So I don't have to love myself. Jesus loves me.
Wisconsin snowplow drivers love Issues Etc.
We don't tend to think about pop culture as anything other than kind of the bubblegum fluff, the cotton candy, a culture that trivializes everything, that makes everything sweet, saccharine, or entertaining. And that's certainly all true about pop culture, but could it be that pop culture is, in fact, a matter of life and death as well? Welcome back to Issues Etc. live this Tuesday afternoon, the 26th of January. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Pastor Jonathan Fisk is going to join us for our biweekly series on pop culture today, Pop Culture as a Culture of Death. Pastor Tom Baker will join us after that. We'll teach a Sunday school lesson, The Boy Jesus in the Temple, in Luke chapter 2. Now, you can join us for the next hour. Our call-in number, 1-877-623-MY-IE, 877-623-6943. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org, a tweet at issuesetc. Our beloved on-demand listeners, whenever or wherever you listen, use the Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8382. Joining us to talk about pop culture as a culture of death, Pastor Jonathan Fisk, pastor of St. John's Lutheran Church in Oaks, North Dakota, creative director of Worldview Everlasting TV, and author of the book Broken, Seven Christian Rules That Every Christian Ought to Break as Often as Possible. Jonathan, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We don't usually think of pop culture as a matter of life and death. Why should we entertain that idea?
Well, as we talked about before, pop culture is just a phrase to describe kind of the lowest common denominator of what we in our society, where we communicate in this mass media blurb, what we actually believe, teach, and confess about truth. And so every worldview or every culture, every set of thinking has a catechism, has something that it echoes, a set of beliefs that it comes back to again and again. Another way of saying that would be that every culture has a doctrine, it has a teaching, it has a foundational set of ideas at its root. And just because you're dealing with the fluff on top, you know, the saccharine you said, the way that that is the most common or makes it the most sweet, doesn't mean you're not still expressing the really deep held beliefs that undergird or found the entire cultural way of thinking and speaking. And so American culture, it'll have these areas where you have your deeper level of art, your deeper level of philosophy or what have you. But if it truly is American culture, it's still going to come out in that pop expression. And those who study this in like art history, I mean, they usually will attribute, you got several years of trickle-down effect sometimes. But even so, your most important beliefs, what is the meaning of life? Why are we here? Where do we come from? What is death? What is the value of death or the lack thereof? All of these also are going to be part of your pop culture. I think my concern, particularly this past weekend, as I lightly followed the news on the March for Life in Washington, D.C., and particularly how little there was news in any of the mass media outlets, was that top to bottom, American culture is a culture of death. It is a culture that does not believe in a future. And there's a lot that we could say in talking about that, but I think it's important to recognize that this isn't just your radical progressives trying to sell baby parts. Everything about our culture, even in its most pop form, if you look, take a careful look at it, you can diagnose it as a culture that rejects the future of the human race. And that's kind of it's a terrifying thing. And as Christians, it's certainly something we want to guard our hearts and minds against, because we have a future in the resurrection of Jesus and his return. And we definitely don't want to lose sight of that, swallowed up by a culture that says, you know, I'll quote Paul a little bit here, you know, eat, drink, be merry, for tomorrow we die.
So what you're saying here is that pop culture isn't just superficially kind of a trivializing thing. It's pervasively a trivializing thing. Everything is trivialized in service of what? I mean, what is it? If we trivialize something, it's always to raise something else up. What is it that pop culture values above all else, so that it devalues even human life?
Right. And, you know, I think the word trivialize is an interesting one, because it does do that, but it does so in an attempt to summarize it. It's trying to boil it all down to the thing we can all swallow, right? And what is it doing with that? If we wanted to go to like classic terminology, you can go back to the ideas of hedonism or epicureanism or anything like that. But what it is it's also just classically sin. What is it that everybody is willing to swallow? Momentary pleasure. A little bit better now, even if I have to maybe suffer for it later. And if you can, let's just kind of make a massive intuitive leap here, but if you can kind of think of that person who doesn't have a problem with what Planned Parenthood has been doing, selling the baby parts, because they believe that this is going to, at some point in the future, create a better present for a living adult who's sick and help them get out of that, you can see how their mindset is driven by that moment of momentary pleasure, not by any sort of universal reality about the human race and our value. My value is only as valuable as my pleasurable moment. And all of our culture is kind of living and breathing in this reality. That is, in one sense, the definition of capitalism. And I don't, you know, like talking about capitalism's negatives, because people always think when I accuse you of being against it. I'm not really against it, but I do recognize that it's built on human greed. It's a way of kind of curbing all of our sinful desires, so we only take advantage of each other, in ways that are beneficial to each other. It was kind of odd like that, but at the end of it, what it's become for us now is this hunger for pleasure in the moment that is so great and so strong and so oppressive even, that we are willfully blind to the death of thousands and millions. We are willfully blind to the Holocaust, to the murder of our own future, of our own children. Esau sold a promise and a birthright for porridge, and I think he looks like a pretty righteous man compared to a culture that will sell its own baby's body parts for a promise of a few more years, hanging outside just before I got to go to the nursing home. There is something deeply wrong at our heart. And so in one sense, Todd, your question, though, you know, could you have pop in a culture that's not American culture? I think you could. I think you could have this, like, summarized, trivial version of whatever is driving their worldview. The problem with our culture isn't its pop. That's just lowbrow. That's all that is. That's blue collar. That's folk, right? The problem with our culture is what's underneath the culture, which is Nietzsche's atheism. It is at best moralistic therapeutic deism, but that deism that's in there, that God isn't really real. He isn't really one who has a judgment of any kind. The therapy is the driving factor, the moment of pleasure or increase in my value as expressed now or as experienced now. That's the driving factor. And that is what makes them, listening to this pop culture, it is a matter of life or death when you listen to its message. Because if you're not going to guard your heart and your mind with the words of Christ, you can't help but begin to believe the message that it sends. When the catechism that you are studying is the pop culture's media stream, and you aren't studying another catechism, you aren't getting doctrine from somewhere else, like the scriptures, eventually you're going to just repeat, you're going to echo what you've heard. I mean, this is how humans learn, is how we act. We always are just saying what we heard somewhere else. And so the issue is which catechism are you going to really use to define your worldview? And if you're going to just let the pop culture define it for you, you are going to end up with Nietzsche's atheism, at least in practice.
You say a part of a feature of our pop culture is that it worships youth, and this, either intentionally or unintentionally, works into a culture of death. Tell us about that.
Yes. Sorry, I don't know if you can hear someone just set the alarm here, and it's going to beep for a few minutes. For whatever reason, as we're trying to get into the absolute pleasure of the moment, we've also then realized that the young have that more than we do. There's something about a generation that went before that didn't have as much pleasure, that wanted to give it to the kids when they could have it. And this sort of happened to the baby boomers. It's definitely happened to my culture a lot, that life experience got better and better. We had more money and more things offered to us. And so in that, the youth have been able to kind of relish their youth all the more. And as they grow in that relishing of the youth, we see that, we glorify that, we take pictures of it, and then it becomes the thing that we all want to be. Man, that alarm is 30 minutes. It's about to be done. Oh, sorry about that. Golly. It's totally distract. We have two offices, and they both have the same alarm. So when one gets set, my door was shut for the call, and so it made that noise. So we set up the youth as this. First off, we give them everything that we could possibly want and try to live vicariously through them. And then seeing that, we try to be them too, right? And so growing the new youth, they see the youth that they're being painted as. It's the MTV culture that they're being fed, even if it's not through MTV anymore. And then as we go older, we try to reach back and hold on to it because we see, and it is an old proverb, right? Youth is wasted on the young. But the more that we are identifying this youth, interestingly, the less we value marriage, the less we value family, and then the less we value children. So as we worship youth, we gradually despise children. And it's a weird paradox how this happens. But as I'm trying to maintain my youngness, the thing that most gets in the way of me staying young is me having offspring.
So this is the unintended consequence, because it's not a worship of youth as an idea or young people. It's a worship of my own youth, is what you're saying.
Yeah. It's a worship of my own pleasure and my belief that the key to pleasure is to remain young. So there's a proverb in the scriptures: gray hair is a crown to be worn with honor. That's a foolish statement in our culture. You know, I don't know. You can quote that one and people laugh at it. Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like the pious laugh, like ha ha, yeah. It's in the Bible, so I can't say no. But yeah, no one believes that, right? And certainly, the youth aren't taught to believe that. They're not taught to value age over their beauty. It's all about live life while you got it, right? The very idea of the college experience, as at least as it was pitched to me in the culture, you know, Animal House and whatnot. It's sow your wild oats, because this is the time. You know, after this, you're going to get married with that old ball and chain, then it's all done, right? Then you lose your moment. So live in the moment as long as you can. And what you see among my generation is people who said, well, if I am going to live in the moment as long as I can, I'm going to do it till I'm 40 or further. You know, I'm not going to marry her. We're not going to have kids. We're going to get two incomes, and we're going to travel, and we're going to do whatever we want. And then you got, you know, half of the Christian world is kind of like, how did this ever happen? And again, you know, as well, it happened through the philosophy that was pitched in the culture. It happened through the advertisement that we grew up eating. And it hasn't been countered. The church has yet to say, at least in a real public way, that we are different from this American society. We're still trying to save it, right? We talked about the political debates. I don't want to knock on anyone too much. I can knock on all of them. But when Ted Cruz calls on the body of Christ to rise up and vote for him, we're still trying to have the church save the culture. We're trying to have the church in America be the same thing. And this was never the case in the first place. But all the more is it not the case because of that foundational set of catechetical truths or repeated truths that drive what the society is. And if you look in Scripture for those truths, you find the Ten Commandments, you find the Creed, you find the Lord's Prayer, you find Jesus forgiving you through Word and Sacrament. You don't find democracy. You don't find pleasure. You don't find a career. You don't even find purpose, right? Rick Warren's purpose-driven life is an embracing of the postmodern contextualized value, that my ultimate value is derived in a relative term to what I'm able to do now, as opposed to, can you imagine a book called The Duty-Driven Life? Right, I know, 7 steps to finding what you're supposed to do because God said so. Right, I mean that wouldn't sell. Right, and it's because the purpose thing is about me. It plays on my sin, but B, the culture is there to support this this relativistic view of value. It's not there to support that God is a judge, that we are in rebellion against Him, and that Jesus is risen from the dead. Why do we expect the culture to do that? I don't think we should expect the culture to do that. But we are entering a time where we definitely need to be more vigilant against it. And again, I think the abortion reality is sort of the bellwether around a lot of this can just be seen happen. Marriage has become that now more as well with the transgender, homosexuality, all this kind of stuff. And if we think that abortion and marriage are separate issues, then we're fooling ourselves there too. So sexuality becomes a part of this. What is the purpose of man and woman being made? Yeah. What is our duty and our reason for existence? And all of that, the church has one answer and the culture has another. If we're going to march for life and want to see that be something that changes, it's got to start by changing our view of marriage and life within our churches and recognizing that it's going to be a very different worldview than what the culture is going to sing about on a Friday night.
Pastor Jonathan Fisk is our guest at our biweekly series on pop culture today. Pop culture is a culture of death. Still a lot left to talk about with him on the other side of the break on this Tuesday afternoon, January the 26th. We'll talk about not only a worship of youth, but along with it goes a worship of being single and autonomous. And, it often leads to, again, a culture of death. We'll find out how right after this. Standing Firm in a Hostile World is the theme of the San Antonio Biblical Worldview Conference, February 5th and 6th. This confessional Lutheran conference features Issues Etc. guest Adam Francisco, David J. Weber, Joe Abrahamson, attorney Mark Stern, and Professor Alan Quist. If you are in Texas or would like some warmer weather in February, check out the San Antonio Biblical Worldview Conference, February 5th and 6th at faithlutheransa.org. faithlutheransa.org.
Many Lutheran pastors outside of the U.S. receive little or no seminary education. Luther Academy provides theological triage through conferences, books, and journals. Help support Luther Academy by making a tax-deductible donation at lutheracademy.com or call 260-452-2211. Serving Lutheran pastors to the ends of the earth. Luther Academy, 260-452-2211 or lutheracademy.com.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Not only does our church need men right now, but the world needs men who will proclaim the gospel in its purity.
Issues, Etc. regular guest, Dr. Peter Scair, Associate Professor of New Testament at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
If when you go to sleep at night, you're thinking about it, my experience with it is this, is that thought won't go away. So if you're going to bed at night thinking about following our Lord and becoming a preacher of this gospel, then I would love if you could come and visit Fort Wayne, our campus. We'd love to show you around and show you what it is that we do.
Have you ever considered becoming a pastor? Contact Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana at 1-800-481-2155, 800-481-2155, or visit ctsfw.edu. Christ-centered, cross-focused, Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about pop culture as a culture of death in our biweekly series with Pastor Jonathan Fisk, who is creative director of Worldview Everlasting Television. You can find out about their new program under the Listen on Demand page, new program called Daily Fix, and others there under the Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org. Issuesetc.org, click Listen on Demand. Jonathan, you kind of edged into this before the break, and that is it's a pop culture that also worships singleness, and that great lengths to which people will go to remain single and yet still enjoy all of the benefits of married life. Talk about that.
Yeah, and I don't think anyone who's paying attention is unaware of the basic reality, right, which is that people are getting married at later and later ages and they're delaying childbearing. What I think maybe the connection has not been drawn is that this is very much connected to a lot of what we're teaching our children about the value of life and what life's really about. So when you raise a child to believe that my experience, my pleasure, is kind of the primary thing, and then they are not reinforced with an understanding of sex as connected to childbearing at all, it's just totally a separate idea to them, then what is to keep them from having sex before they're married and from engaging in that with multiple partners or for as long as they can. And if we're going to stand there and expect them to just kind of keep the sixth commandment because we say so, but if it as a meaningless commandment, as a commandment detached from any real design of our creation, we're really expecting them to be far better Christians than we are, I guess I would say. They're not going to be able to do that because they're not going to see the reason for it. They're going to believe in this God of therapy, the God who wants them to be happy, and that if sex makes us happy and if we love each other, why not? Connected to this then is this bizarre twist too, where we've almost so valued that pleasure of the sexual environment and made it a part of what youth is supposed to be about. I'm supposed to be able to have sex with people and not have children, that suddenly in our culture everything's sexualized. Things that before were not connected to sex are. My local public school here, they've had to tell the third grade class kids, as 8-year-olds, not to use the word hot, H-O-T. They keep using the word to describe things. And so my 8-year-old has or would say something like, the new Star Wars movie is hot. And it's interesting, it's the opposite of cool in one sense, right, if you think about the words literally. But what she means is that it's cool. The new Star Wars movie is cool. And yet the word hot comes to mean cool by way of being a sexual term for describing a woman, an attractive woman, or a dog in heat, right? And that this mixing of terminology, that words that are used to describe sex, even the word sexy itself, has come to be the way in which we talk about things that are good. So things that are good are things that are sexy. Things that are not sexy are bad. And yet by sex, we certainly do not mean marriage. and we certainly do not mean fidelity, and we certainly do not mean children. What we mean is pornography, right, in some way. What we mean is the idolatry or the glamorizing of rampant hedonistic sex. And the third graders that are using the language, they have no idea. They have no clue what they're saying or how this is connected. But then the adults are hearing this, and they're making the connection and forbidding the word. The kids don't even know why they've been told not to say the word. my 8-year-old's asking me, why aren't we allowed to say the word hot? What's wrong with that? And I'm trying to explain it to her, in her terms and whatnot. But what is going on is, again, this worship of youth by way of youth and pleasure being fulfilled most clearly in the 20-year-old age group as sex is now affecting, again, the echo of culture, the echo of the media stream, even down at these really, really low levels. So that while they're not able to pick up yet on actually being sexualized themselves, although that's happening more and more, they are picking up on the language of sexuality as a way of talking about what's normal. This is just bizarre, right? We should be kind of looking at this and just scratching our heads. How did we get here? And yet you can trace how we got here. What was the 60s? It was the sexual revolution, right? And yeah, sure, it was about women in the workforce. That's part of it. But it was about a lot more than that. It was about procreation. It was about what man and woman are together, what we're designed for, and rejecting that. Regardless of what, you know, abuses had been done before, and I'm not going to say that there weren't abuses chauvinism before the 60s. I think there probably were. I didn't live there, so I can't say for sure. It's in the books, but there probably were. But even so, in that overturning of the chauvinism, we've flipped this thing in a totally different direction that really isn't much better, and we have revolted against the sexuality as God designed it. So I don't know where we're going to go from that. I mean, what is our answer to this? Maybe is the next question, and part of that is a repentant awareness that all of us, as subjects of a culture. And this is, I'm not saying this about you or me or anyone personally. I'm saying that everybody that lives in a culture is going to reflect and echo that culture. And that part of Christianity, the reason why we come in and get on our knees every week one way or the other, is for us to confess that whatever culture we are, it's evil. At its core, it's built on a rebellion against God, and we need that evil to be addressed by His Word and Sacrament, which means His law and His gospel. And in that, then we have much to learn now in the church about the sixth commandment, and how to address it from everything. How do we prepare our young people to get married, to how do we help our old men stop using pornography, and all of that in the above. And how do we stand apart? How do we look different than the world around us? I'm not talking, you know, you can look different by wearing funny clothing, or you can look different by believing humanity is a different thing. And again, I'll say it again, if we want to stop the culture of death from killing the babies with abortion, then we have to redeem God's word about marriage. I don't think you can fight one battle without the other. It's going to be almost impossible.
You're not the first to note, but it certainly is very important to note that the you know, one of the steps that is taken here, is, as you say, is to divorce all of this, human sexuality, even nowadays gender, from procreation. And at first you don't think that that's necessarily such a bad thing until you realize the end result of it. What is it?
The end result is a culture without a future, because it has no children. And this is a hard scientific fact at the moment in demographics, and you have not many Christians aware of this. You have a lot more business people aware of sort of a collapse of Western civilization from within in its workforce of educated workers, because we are not replacing ourselves. And that is a tremendous global problem. So on the one hand, you have the mythology of the population bomb, where we're going to have too many people. That's a 1980s guess that was probably wrong then and has been just repeated enough that people think it's common wisdom now. You have that narrative's out there in the media somewhere still. But on the other side, you have this gradual collapsing of actual cultures. And the churches in America, as we have lost our numbers over the last 30 and 40 years, part of it is, you know, catechism is a crisis and we need to deal with it. We haven't kept the ones we have, but we just haven't had enough to replace ourselves. And that's a real direct physical reality. There's no way to escape it. On top of that, then, we have in our midst our children who are Christians, who say they want to be Christian and yet cannot see family or children as a valuable thing. I received an email, or it was in one of our private Facebook groups with the show that we do, of a woman who said she has young women coming to her for counsel, saying, you know, I really never want to get married or have kids. And these are young women, grade school and high school age. I just don't see this as being something good, and that this is happening. That we have brought about now a generation that actually doesn't care about their future and the future of their society, the future of their family name. And for me, the future of the church, passing this on to somebody, it's appalling. What do we do but stand in awe of our own arrogance or ignorance, one or the other or both, fall at the font and at the altar and beg Jesus to turn this thing around for us? It's not like, you know, Rome has always kind of been right and wrong with this. It's sort of like having children is your duty to the church, so have 15, and if you die in the process, you know, you better just kind of be ready to meet your maker. Well, that's not right either. I mean, there's a legalism there that's quite dangerous. But there is a place where we can return to and find what Luther says in the Catechism, the Large Catechism, which is that the sixth commandment is to be taught to our children that they would adore the idea of marriage, that they would seek marriage for the sake of having children, and that they would raise children for the sake of them doing their duty to church and to the world. I think the old terminology that Walter Lieg even used to use was for altar and hearth, right? For the home and for the sanctuary. If we're going to divide procreation from sex altogether and say they have nothing to do with each other, that birth control has no effect on society, we're blind to the science at this point. The science has made it clear for us. But I think we're also, sadly, maybe trying to justify ourselves in the face of our rejection of something very good, which is what marriage is as a gift to the church, to the world. And, you know, we can go further with this if we want to talk about the image of Christ and his bride as well. When Malachi says, as the prophet, you know, what did God desire of you? Godly offspring is the answer he gives. He's not just talking about people having kids. He's talking about the church and what Christ has done in the church, bringing about a new race of mankind redeemed from the pit of hell. And that marriage, bearing children, is a picture of this. Yeah, just as much as the bride and the bridegroom are a picture as well of Christ and his people and his fidelity to them. So what do we stand to lose? A lot. Yeah. Do we hope to somehow repopulate our congregations by converting people? Do you realize that it's easier to convert people you raise in your house than the guy you meet on the street who doesn't know you from Adam and is already bought hook, line, and sinker into the catechism of the world? Those kinds of ideas are ones we definitely need to wrestle with again. And I know they're not happy ideas. They're not really fun ones. And we certainly don't want to turn this into some sort of attempt to save things based on our works. I mean, that never works. But there is a point where we do have to sort of recognize that the abortion industry and the marriage industry with the homosexual edge attached onto it now, there's a lot of room for us to repent and return to the basic catechism and say, you know, what does this mean? Have we forgotten? And before we go wagging our fingers at the world, maybe we should take a look at our own house.
With only 30 seconds here, Jonathan, if this were coming to us from kind of stiff academics who are saying we should worship youth and we should divorce sex from procreation, a lot of people would probably see through it, at least initially. But it comes to us in the form so often, so very, very entertaining. With 30 seconds, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, and this gets back to the heart of the series, right, that the medium of visual media with sound connected to it is the most subtle of deceivers. It can give you an idea you never knew you even had, and later you think you thought it up yourself, and it was just planted there by the entertainment over time or long ago. And it doesn't do it by kind of lecturing to you about ideas. It does it through story. It does it through advertisement. And it's dangerous. It's powerful. I think the church needs to use it, frankly. You know, that's what Worldview Everlasting Television is an attempt to do. Lutheran satire being another great example of this, is trying to kind of pull you in with the entertainment and then leave you with an idea you didn't have before you started. I don't know how we cannot engage in that war. And sometimes I'm concerned we don't do enough. But even if we can't, as the church, pull it together and, like, do something positive with the media, we at the very least have to be, as Christians on the ground, recognizing that the pop culture coming across the tube these days, internet included in that, is a catechism. It has an underlying set of values, and that we need to counter it with the catechism we have in the church.
Pastor Jonathan Fisk is pastor of St. John's Lutheran Church in Oaks, North Dakota, creative director of Worldview Everlasting TV, and author of the book Broken, 7 Christian Rules That Every Christian Ought to Break As Often as Possible. Jonathan, thank you very much for being our guest.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
When we come back, we're going to spend some time teaching a Sunday school lesson with Pastor Tom Baker of Law and Gospel. We'll be in Luke chapter 2, the boy Jesus at the temple.
Even if your child has mild to moderate autism, learning disabilities, attention difficulties, or other learning challenges, he can receive a classical Christian education. The Simply Classical curriculum was created by Issues Etc. guest Cheryl Swope, an author, educator with a master's degree in special education, and homeschooling mother of twins with special needs. The Simply Classical curriculum has become an answer to prayer for parents and schools. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and save $5 with the coupon code LPR.
Lord, help us ever to retain the catechism's doctrine plain.
What makes a church unique? Perhaps we should ask what makes a church faithful. Calvary Lutheran Church of Elgin, Illinois, continually learns Christ's doctrine, simply explained in the small catechism. This doctrine teaches us Christ crucified, who even today comes and serves his baptized children in word and sacrament to forgive, strengthen, and teach us for daily life. This, Christ's own work among us, makes and keeps Calvary Lutheran Church faithful. Visit us at clce.org.
We Lutherans were never aided by following along with some other tradition's theological priorities and catchphrases.
Issues Etc. regular guest, Pastor Heath Curtis, Coordinator for Stewardship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod on a Lutheran approach to stewardship.
Other folks are not approaching it from our good, solid Lutheran understanding of law and gospel and vocation. There's a place to talk about this in Christianity, and we have a way of talking about stewardship as Lutherans without ever using the word stewardship, if you like. I'm going to talk to you today about your vocation in your home, in your church, in your society, and how each one of these makes a claim on you, on your presence, on your support, on your prayers. That's how we should talk about this as Lutherans.
You'll find several stewardship resources at lcms.org/stewardship, lcms.org/stewardship.
An umbilical cord of biblical truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Steadfast Lutherans, people who believe the law condemns everyone and should be preached to the fullest. People who believe the gospel is for everyone and should be preached to its sweetest. Traditional Lutheran doctrine and practice deliver every Sunday this law and gospel, that Christ was crucified for us sinners. To all who received him, who believed in his name, the Gospel of John says, he gave the right to become children of God. To see how Steadfast Lutherans preserves this good news for everyone, visit steadfastlutherans.org.
You can receive 50% off the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatic Series during Logia's special Reformation sale. Books like The Church by Professor Kurt Marquardt, Christology, Law and Gospel and the Means of Grace, and Baptism by Dr. David Scare, and Eschatology by Dr. John Stevenson. Browse before you buy at logia.org. You'll even find essays by Issues Etc. regular guests for as low as $2. Logia's Reformation Sale, logia.org, L-O-G-I-A.org.